Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny.
This week, Richard Skinner of Faber Academy on writing a novel.
Richard Skinner is a novelist, poet, and critic. His most recent book, The Mirror, was described as beautifully written, immersive, and captivating by The Guardian. As director of the fiction programme at Faber Academy, he created the flagship Writing a Novel six-month course in 2009, and since then has helped hundreds of writers find their voice. And as an extension to that, he's now the author of Writing a Novel, Bringing Your Ideas to Life, the Faber Academy Way, which we're going to talk about. Richard, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
So tell us what the idea behind the book is, first of all.
Yeah, so the idea behind the book is that we've been running the course very successfully for 9 years now, and Faber and I were chatting for a long time about putting what goes on in the course, or some of what goes on the course, into a book of some kind. And here we are. It's finally out, but it's been a long time coming. We sort of first mooted it about 5 or 6 years ago, but it just takes time for books to come out, for me to put it all together. I think it looks great. Faber have done a great job on the cover. It's all very sparkly. It's very nice. It's doing very well, which is great. So, I'm very happy.
And the course started in 2009. How has the whole sort of genre of creative writing changed in that time? You know, there's often, every now and then, every couple of years, there'll be a think piece in one of the broadsheets about the creative writing course novel is ruining literature, sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a very boring debate now. I think the argument's been one that creative writing courses are just as valid for writers as studying music or studying art is for musicians or painters. You know, why shouldn't you go and study writing in the same way that you study painting and music? And the other part of your question is interesting, because there is this criticism of creative writing courses that they produce homogenized novels, you know, the same amount of sort of incident and conflict and characterization. But I reject that, because what we do at Faber Academy is, it's not a prescriptive course. You know, we don't say, right, you have to do this or this in order for your novel to be workable or readable. What we say is, write the novel that you want to write, that's inside you, that's in your heart, in your soul, in your gut. And we will try and provide the space and the time, the structure, the guidance and the support to do that. But it's really up to them what they do. It's not up to us to drill into them, you know, how to write a novel. It's really, we're trying to release a fountain of them. And I think that's backed up by the really very wide range of novels that Faber Academy people have published, you know, everything from very literary to very, very commercial. So, you know, we don't sort of say that here's the model, you've got to fit this model and then you'll be published. We say, write what's in your heart and we'll help you.
So what sort of person signs up for, I'm particularly thinking of the six-month course here, because it's not something you can just write a check for and turn up. You do have to apply and be accepted.
Oh, absolutely. No, we ask for a letter and 1,000 words of your prose. It can be anything, it can be any 1,000 words. And the letter is very revealing as well. Everyone thinks that the 1,000 words is the thing, but actually the letter too is very revealing. It's very competitive now because of our success and because of we've had a lot of publicity in the last year or so. The kinds of people who apply are, well, all sorts, you know, everything from recent graduates to people who've just retired.
But are they generally people that have got something already to bring to it? Have they started a novel and are stuck?
Yeah, mostly. But we say to people, you know, you don't have to have written, you know, a lot of a novel. You don't even have to have started a novel. Maybe most people come with an idea for a novel and they use the course to kickstart that novel. So people come to the course for different reasons, and everyone in the class is in a different place when they arrive, and they're in a very different place when they leave as well. The point is not what everyone else is doing, it's obviously what you're doing and how you've benefited from the course, hopefully, and you know where you are and how confident you feel about your book. By the end, that's the most important thing, rather than word count or finishing a draft or whatever.
So we're going to go through some of the chapters of the book, some of the themes you look at that would be taught on the course, but before we do that, like you just mentioned that this is not a prescriptive course, but let's perhaps talk about what are some things that you can't teach prospective novelists.
That's a great question, and I talk about that in the introduction, actually. One thing I think that we can't teach, and we shouldn't teach even if we could, is this idea of, you know, style or voice. So, you know, everyone has their own way of writing. They have their own timbre or tone, you know, a register, and we can't teach that. That's to do with your personality, to do with the very core of your being. But what we can do on the course is look at story and structure. How best to tell your story? What kind of story do you want to tell, and how best to tell it? And the way in which you tell it, in terms of style, that's your concern. We can't test or model or mold that, but we can look at story and what makes a good story, what drives a story forward, what do readers look for in a story, you know, those kinds of things. And those things can be learned, they can be tested, they can be played with. But someone's style at the end of the day just comes about through confidence, practice, belief, hard work, you know, all those things. It can't be taught, it can only be earned. And I think any creative writing course that claims to be able to do that, you know, frankly, they're charlatans.
So the story then, this is the first aspect we're going to look at. And I mean, it might seem a pretty obvious thing to say, but the story is central here, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, I think it is. You know, that's debatable. What I would say is that a story is something that is kind of overlooked, rather surprisingly. That might sound very weird, but it's rather overlooked by a lot of new writers, because a lot of new writers are trying to find their voice, and they're trying to find expression, you know, because writing is a fulfillment of personality or expression in some way. But I think one of the things we're hot on at the Academy is that's great, but you've got to hang that on something that's going to be appealing and interesting and accessible to readers. So, you know, a novel isn't just a stage where you just actualize yourself. You're trying to tell a story as well that people are going to relate to and be moved by and understand. So, yeah, story is all important. I mean, not every great novel has to have a great storyline in terms of, you know, thrust and drive. But I think every great novel is a great story.
There's some exercises in the book that look at, you know, the very beginning of this process, how writers come up with ideas. Again, let's talk about that. Where did these ideas come from?
Another great question, because as you know that I talk a lot about this, and it's kind of it's the first thing to happen in a way. I think, you know, great ideas for novels, we all have them, don't we? You know, we all think, oh, it'd be a great idea for a novel, and oh yeah, that would be a great story. But really, would it? You know, you kind of have to test it in your head, make sure that it really does have legs to turn itself into a novel. And I think the way of finding out whether your idea is a good one for a novel is to really look very particularly at what you read, first of all. One of the things in the book, one of the exercises in the book, is to just make a list of some favourite novels, and almost always there's some kind of common theme running through those novels, and it's something that we do at the Academy, both on the one-day course we do called Start to Write, and also in one of the first weeks of writing a novel, the six-month course. Just make a list of your favourite novels and have a look. Think about them. What's the thing in common? And there's always something in common. you know, because you are the common link, so there's got to be. And sometimes it takes some people a little time to work out what that is, but when you do find out what that is, it's a very powerful discovery. And the point of the exercise is, you know, when I say, well, perhaps that's what you should be writing about. If that theme running through the novels, all of the novels that you love so much, it obviously touches you. So it's got to be something you want to write about.
And I guess that's presuming that all of these people could put together a list of 10 favourite novels. How important, Richard, is reading?
Absolutely important. You know, I think it's the most important thing for a writer to do, even more than writing, you know, is just read, 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 be influenced, be challenged, be expanded, be inspired. And all books start from books that you've read, you know, all books written start from books that you've read, I think.
And one of the other parallel points to, you know, where do ideas come from, is this idea of, you know, what do you want to say? What are you trying to say with this novel? And, I mean, obviously on this show we cover a lot of, you know, literary fiction where it's like, you know, it's reasonably obvious that this is a story that happens to also be about something else. I don't know, what is Dan Brown or whatever trying to say?
Well, you know, I've got enormous respect for Dan Brown.
He sells a lot of books.
He's sold a lot of books, and that's difficult to do.
But what I'm trying to get at, are we always trying to say something, is, I guess, the point.
I think so, deep down. You know, even Dan Brown, I think, must be trying to say something. I mean, you know, why write unless you feel compelled to say something, to share an opinion, a thought, or express yourself? But obviously there's a sort of a, you know, a difference between highly commercial fiction like Dan Brown and, you know, someone like Henry James or Proust or someone like that. Obviously, they're very different. And, you know, I think of Hemingway and Proust as very interesting writers to think about on this issue, because they were both alive at the same time and living in the same city, Paris, but they were writing very, very different kind of fiction, and they were coming from completely different places in the world and schools of thinking, and they are the North and South Pole of writing in a way, and I think we all fit in somewhere between them. But, you know, you have Hemingway on the one side, you know, of whom Dan Brown is definitely a disciple, you know, very, very driven, very fast, very declarative sentences. It's all just dialogue and action. Then you've got Proust, it's very sort of interior and very descriptive. It just depends what kind of sensibility you have as a writer, you know, whether you want to write something that's very beautiful and very, you know, poetic, or whether you want to kind of just concentrate on action and you know, pushing something forward. And there's room for everyone.
So we've got an idea. I've come to you with an idea for a novel. It's a great captivating story, I don't know, about, you know, a middle-aged podcaster who for some reason also happens to work as a government spy and is inexplicably attractive to women. Now I've got the story, and it's, you know, it's obviously going to be a bestseller, but there's more to just the story. We need to certainly structure it first of all. So how do we put a loose structure on this story that's, first of all, it's not going to finish too quickly, but also, you know, my maverick podcaster spy, his character is going to develop over the course of the novel. How do we sort of structure that?
Well, I think you've got to think about it in two ways, sort of on the macro level, on the micro level. So on the macro level, I would say you should start thinking about structure. Scenes, just write on a piece of paper the numbers 1 to 30 and write next to each number your story's main events. You know, sounds like a very simple thing to do, but my God, it's illuminating and a powerful exercise to do. Much more difficult than you think it'll be. You know, so what's the overall architecture of it? Do you have an ending? It doesn't matter if you don't, but I think you should roughly know where it's going. You know, you should probably know a half a dozen key events along the way. You can fill in the details as you go. And then on the micro level, you've got to sort of think about scenes. Where are people? What's happening? Who's interacting? Why? What do they want? Who's stopping them from getting it? And what do they say to each other? And just working from the bottom up, just putting people in a room and getting them talking, that's very difficult to do. But it's the bread and butter of novel writing is scenes.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Richard Skinner. We're talking about his book, Writing a Novel. And Richard, we've put together a ridiculous story and a tentative structure for it. Obviously, the events that happen in that story could happen in lots of different ways, in lots of different orders. We could go backwards and forwards in time, for instance, depending on how we want to structure it. So I want to talk about what the difference is between story and plot.
Yeah. So this is something that I think certainly I took a long time to understand. It's something that we talk a lot about at Faber Academy, and I think it's at the core of storytelling. Is so, you know, everyone knows the stories of Cinderella or Achilles or Hamlet. You know, you do and I do. But if we were both to go away and write our version of Cinderella or Achilles or Hamlet, obviously it would be wildly different. So that the story of those characters is the same. We know the story of Cinderella and Achilles and Hamlet. But you and I would make a series of decisions about how best to tell that. You know, should we start at the end and then flash back to the beginning and then, you know, arrive back at the end? Or should we start in the middle of the story? Or should we start at the beginning? So I think, you know, one of the key things you have to do as a writer is to make decisions about ordering. How am I going to tell this? What's the best way to tell this story? Do I want to make it into a thriller or a mystery or a drama? You know, what effects do I want to create? And you can create different effects by ordering story events in different ways. Again, it's to do with what we enjoy reading and the kinds of books that appeal to us. And we usually want to emulate in our own writing the kind of books that we love reading.
Let's talk about characters for a bit, because I want to talk about how to create a convincing character. And there's a couple of methods that you mentioned in the book, outside in versus inside out. So can you tell us what they are?
Yeah, so this is something that I did a lot with my classmates when I did the UEA MA creative writing a while ago now. And we all had, you know, questionnaires, 40 questions that we filled out for all of our characters, and you know, things like what was their favorite color, how did they vote, what secrets did they have, what pets did they keep, etc., etc. And that was great. And that's what I mean by outside in. You know, sort of just you're just looking at these characters from the outside into their lives. But really, I think you've got to do it in a different way if you're really going to grapple with great characters, which is to really get to know them from the inside out and to be able to see the world from their point of view, feel what they feel, know how they would react in any given situation. I know that sounds like an obvious thing to say, and it sounds unfair of me to say that that's how it's got to be without giving any kind of concrete way of doing that. But the truth is, there's no concrete way of doing that. The only way that you can really start seeing the story from your character's point of view is by entering into the story as fully as possible, you know, immersing it, committing to it, immersing yourself in it, just believing in yourself, because you want to write this story so much and you love these characters so much, and it will happen. You know, there's a sweet spot or a wormhole or a rabbit hole at some point that you can fall down and enter the story via. And when you do that, the story will happen quite naturally, I believe.
And as well as creating a character that seems convincing to the reader, obviously they also have to participate in this story. Let's talk about what's their motivation, as they always say in Hollywood. There are things that are going to happen to the character, desires that they have, desires that may be thwarted along the way.
Yeah, you know, I just think without characters wanting something, and there's no story really, you know, if your character is happy with his or her lot and doesn't feel any kind of lack or desire, then there's no story, frankly, because there's no drive, there's no conflict. So I think storytelling, right the way back to Aristotle, is all about putting characters who are not happy with what they've got and showering them with circumstance and putting them under pressure to, first of all, drive them towards what they want, but also to stop them from getting what they want. You know, you as the author are in a very peculiar and particular situation where you're rooting for your main character to succeed, but you're the one that's got to put obstacles in their way from succeeding. And it's a very, very peculiar thing to do, you know, but you've got to. They can't achieve their success too easily, and well, neither can they, you know, not achieve anything at all. Well, they can. I mean, Beckett's a great example of that. Beckett breaks all the rules of everything, and none of his characters achieve anything in any of his, you know, plays or fiction. But he's a one-off. Characters have got to want things, and it's your job to put them under pressure.
So the other thing we also have to choose for our story is which point of view it's going to be told from. And there's a number of options here, obviously.
Yeah, obviously, you know, first and third person, everyone's heard of that. You know, there's the more sort of omniscient narrator, which is the great Victorian model. You know, big eye in the sky, just sort of scanning its gaze across the whole of society. First person is great for very intimate narratives, so confessional narratives or confidence tricks like Lolita, unreliable narration, you know, and it's wonderful to write in the first person because you're free. You have no constraints, I find anyway. You can just say or do whatever you like. You have to be in the frame of mind of the main character, obviously. I wrote a book called The Velvet Gentleman from the point of view of Eric Satie, the French composer, and I had such fun writing that book because I just, you know, once I got his voice and his humour, I had a field day with him. But if you want to write something that's got a bit more scope, you know, and a bit more scale, something that, like, the third person is much better because you can move around, you can move point of view between different people and get a sort of, you know, kaleidoscopic view of the same event. Richard Price's book Freedomland, which was made into a movie quite a while ago now, but that's a wonderful novel. It's about the abduction of a baby in New York, and it's told from lots of different points of view, but it's all these different points of view on this one act, and gradually the truth unfolds about what happened to the baby. And, you know, you just couldn't do that in a first person narrative. So again, it depends what kind of book you want to write, what kind of effect you want to achieve. But you can select the kinds of tools and techniques that are available to you as a writer in order to write the kind of book you want to write.
There's another familiar aphorism here, which I must admit I've never really understood myself until I read your book. Tell us what we actually mean when we say show, don't tell.
The old chestnut. Yeah, it's unfortunately it's a cliche, but it's a cliche for a reason, because it is an aphorism which really gets to the heart of, I think, you know, what good storytelling is. So I'm sure most people understand what that means. But going deeper into that idea is the idea that new writers often struggle to have the confidence to let the story and the characters speak for themselves. That's basically what it is that new writers, they underestimate the reader and they feel that they need to bring in a spokesperson into the text to explain or clarify or to reassure or emphasize to the reader what was apparent in the unfolding of the story naturally anyway. So, you know, if two people have a fight, you know, and then the narrator says they fought bitterly and one of them went to their room or something, you know, we know that. We've just seen it. We don't need to be told by the narrator that that was the case. It's usually a sign of unconfidence, but it's the easiest trap for us all to fall in, believe you me. You know, all the way from new writers at the Academy to me to Ian McEwan, we all do it. And that's what first readers and writing groups and creative writing courses are for, is to show you and to teach you that that's the case when it happens. But it's hard to escape. It's like a black hole. It's very hard to escape. When you shake it off, it feels great because, again, it's all to do with the story. And if you're showing and not telling, it means that you're in the zone correctly and you're enjoying the writing and you feel confident about your story. And it's just flowing naturally out of you without any kind of third party butting in and you know, clarifying to the reader what's going on.
We need a setting for our story, and I want to talk about setting with particular reference to the historical novel, which, you know, is a novel like any other, but there are certain particularities to writing historical fiction.
Yeah, so setting is one of those things, as a teacher, I've come to realise is really special, and it's really overlooked. And I think if you do it well, it can really make or break a novel. So in the book, I talk a lot about Wuthering Heights as, you know, a book, probably the ultimate book for me in terms of, you know, marrying or fusing its characters with its setting. I mean, I always talk about the main character, Heathcliff. He's Heathcliff. He is the setting. You know, he doesn't even have a name. He's named after the landscape. And I think Cathy and Heathcliff are really indivisible from the setting in that book. And I think setting is, you know, is worth thinking about differently from the usual way. I think the usual way, which is, you know, sort of Jane Austen and all the way up to from Jane Austen to Thomas Hardy, is that you see a country house. You have it described to you. How big is it? What colour are the bricks? You know, how many windows does it have? But I think, you know, in the 20th and now in this century, I think, you know, we need to think about setting in a slightly different way. I think it's more about a zone of feeling. You know, what do these places mean for characters? What effect have they had on them? How do they connect with them? You know, I think it's a question of fusing character with setting as much as possible. So I think of Camus' The Outsider as another great novel that does that. You know, there's a scene where he's on the beach and he's about to kill the Arab, and this moment is described all through landscape. You know, the sunlight are like needles pricking his skin, and the sun itself is like a clash of symbols, and the waves are like fire rolling in, and it's fantastic.
Just one more question then. So I've sweated over mums and I've finished the first draft of my fantastic novel. I guess I could just send it off to publishing stuff now, can't I?
Well, I would try and get an agent first. That's the best thing to do. I mean, but even before that, you know, if you've written a novel which you think is really great, I think you need to give it to some other people to read first. That's what we do on the course. You know, we do that week in, week out, and you learn a lot from having your work read and also reading other people's work week in, week out. But, you know, if you belong to a writing group or a library writing group, or if you've got a little group of friends, a book club or something like that, just show your work to other people and get some feedback first before you do anything. Don't show it to your mum. Don't show it to your wife or husband. You know, just share it and see what the response is, and act on their feedback, and just keep doing that until you really can't see where else to work on it and you just have no more clue what the hell to do with it. And then you might be ready to show it to, you know, a professional, whether it's a reading service or an agency or but publication and publishers come later. You know, you have to sort of go through the agency process first and get an agent, and then they send on your work to a publisher.
Well, even before that, I did say first draft, and you mentioned in the book that, you know, books aren't necessarily written, they are rewritten.
Yeah, editing for me is the best part of the whole writing process. First drafts are just horrendous, they're just awful. There's so much doubt and uncertainty and confusion, and you're kind of, you know, you're sort of running with this thing. It's like being on a horse trying to escape the tide, you know, but that's good. You just got to get it down, you know, keep going, don't stop until you get it done. And then once you've got a first draft, then you can really heave a huge sigh of relief and have a look at what you've got, and then the fun really starts.
So I've been talking to Richard Skinner. We've been talking about his book Writing a Novel: Bring Your Ideas to Life the Faber Academy Way. Richard, thank you so much for coming in and sharing it with us.
Cheers, thanks very much.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny, and was first broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. Little Atoms is supported by 89UP, and the podcast is hosted by Acast. Find us on iTunes, and if you like the show, please do leave us a review. You can find old interviews, new journalism and more on our website, littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.